As one of America's largest financial services companies, Nationwide makes simplicity a priority so financial professionals can help their clients achieve their retirement goals. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Kathy Jones is here to weigh in. Chief Fixed Income Strategist at Charles Schwab. She's not. Kathy, stay with us. Don't worry, I'm not coming to you on that. Kathy, we all want to know, a 10-year through 350, a two-year approaching 4%. Kathy, are these big buys, either one of them for you?
Well, we like extending duration here. I think it's unsustainable to have the Fed hiking rates at a very rapid rate, doing QT with, you know, the economy slowing. We've had 6 months of declining LEI. We're seeing the housing market decline. These are unsustainable trends. At some stage of the game, the Fed will have to shift, and or, you know, we're just going to go into a deeper recession than we may already be in. And so we do like extending duration, rates could continue to move up. But I think all we're getting is a deeper and deeper inversion of the yield curve here.
And Kathy, this call on extended duration ultimately has to be a call on the economy rolling over. Do you have an idea of the pain threshold the Fed is willing to go through?
Well, I did mention pain for households and businesses last time, and I think there's a willingness to let it continue and worsen, particularly I think the Fed wants to see unemployment rise. They won't say that out loud, but I think they want to see labor conditions not as tight as the way that they'll put it, and they want to see wages slow down. Right now, average hourly earnings running about 5.2% year over year. It's leveled off, it's stabilized, but we haven't seen it decline. And I think their comfort zone is closer to 3% in terms of wage gains than 5%. So that is probably what, you know, they're willing to tolerate. The question is whether, you know, whether risk assets can tolerate that sort of pain.
Kathy, do you care about the dot plot?
Well, we have to, right, because they put it out there. But it's a moving target. I just look at it as a moment in time, guesses. I'm not going to take it too seriously. I think it's a messaging tool. Simply, the Fed will show that they want to hike rates and keep them there for a long time. But it's a moving target.
Kathy, I ask this because there's a question about the credibility of this Federal Reserve, the credibility that they're actually coming up with a thesis that they can follow through on versus just following the market and doing what the market is dictating. How much has that shifted your view of how to operate and how much volatility is going to be injected in these markets at a time when the Fed is not leading anymore? It is apparently following much more what the market's already doing.
Yeah, I think the Fed is in a position now of actually following the inflation data. And we know that inflation is a lagging indicator. We know that monetary policy works with a lag. And so they've shifted instead of saying, hey, we're on top of this. You know, we're taking action. We've got QT on top of a rapid tightening cycle. They've shifted instead of saying, okay, we know that what we're doing will make progress in the future, to reacting to numbers that are coming out today. And that's why the risk is for a deeper and deeper slowdown in the economy. And this is compounded globally. You know, we're seeing this all over the world. And that that makes it even more of a problem for people who are trying to look forward and look at what the Fed is saying versus what the Fed is doing.
How much conviction do you have, Kathy? You were saying it is a good time to go into duration. How much conviction do you have that we've seen the highs or at some of the higher levels for longer term treasuries at a time when you're questioning whether or not we're actually already in a recession, let alone headed for one?
Yeah, we feel pretty confident moving out the curve. We're not all in buying, you know, 30-year bonds or 10-year bonds here, but we do think that it's unsustainable. We're starting to see credit spreads widen a bit, the strains in the economy, the strains in the marketplace, liquidity isn't what it used to be. And so you feel pretty confident that this is a time to start taking advantage of yields where you can lock in, you know, an investment grade portfolio. Right now, you can lock in 4-5% yields without taking a tremendous amount of duration risk. We think that that's a good alternative compared to some of the other asset classes out there.
Kathy, thank you. The brilliant Kathy Jones of Charles Schwab on the bond market. Chris Verein, partner at Head of Technical and Macro Strategist at Chatiga, some bad company. Great call, Chris. I mean, we're so close at 143. I think we came even closer than that. Where next, I guess? And does the BOJ blink?
Yeah. Well, I think they have to. I mean, when you look at yields around the world, U.S. 10s, as we mentioned, are 3.53 this morning. German 10s are basically 2%. We've seen U.K. 10s absolutely run away. And we sit here and Japanese 10-year yields are 26 basis points. I'm just not sure how much longer the BOJ can sustain this cap on yield without losing total control of the yen. So we like dollar yen higher until, frankly, someone breaks. And I think that's the BOJ. So whether that's 150 or 155 or some other level, I think we're on a collision course here that ends with BOJ capitulating, raising the cap on yields to get more in step with what we're seeing around the world.
Chris, have you thought much about how the dominoes fall from there? If that headline dropped, that they stepped away from yield curve control, what it means for bonds, what it means for treasuries?
I mean, I think the initial reaction is maybe you get your blow off in yield. But our experience just has been, I think the historical experience has been bond yields tend to go up until something breaks. And that's why I just don't think that we're done here yet on yields. Our view on yields has simply been they're going to remain stickier and higher than the consensus believes until there's an accident. And I'm not convinced we've quite seen that accident yet.
And the accident comes with longer-term yields rising in addition to short-term yields, possibly what you're talking about with the yield curve control being abandoned in the Bank of Japan and the ripple effects through the rest of the world. What kind of downside are you looking at? How do you sort of hedge against that scenario at a time when it could take a lot longer than people could afford to keep that position on?
Well, I think it just speaks to our overall positioning here, which is play small, go slow, be prudent. Caution is still the word of the day. And, you know, where you really see at least the impact of yields is on what the leadership framework of this market looks like. You have yields up and utilities continue to dominate. So I look at that as a very late cycle message. You know, when you look at the top of the market, the big stocks, the big weights, the one everyone owns, right? A lot of those are already below where they were in June, whether it's Google or whether it's Microsoft. So, you know, you see the impact of yields continuing to hit tech. And I think that's going to remain the story until yields peak, which I just don't think is here.
So when you look out to what's going to happen in the next couple of months, what I'm wrapping my head around is what's the downside here, right? I mean, an accident, how does that ripple through a market when people are saying there isn't the same kind of leverage? You're not seeing the fragility in banks. You have a much more stable base of consumers and their savings and corporate savings. So that's the reason why you have this bid, you have this range. What's going to break that? Will anything, or is that still going to be the reality?
You know, I think that's unclear. The narrative or the consensus is that there's no risk to banks or that consumers are in better shape than we've seen. But I'm going to let the market be the judge of that. When I look kind of at different pockets around the world, I could show you plenty of weak consumer stocks that would suggest that the market might have a very different opinion of that, or plenty of weak bank stocks that would suggest the market has a different opinion of that. So we let the market kind of dictate that. What I think is most important for investors is, you know, the debate on the street is, okay, is S&P going to, you know, revisit or retest or undercut the June lows? And the only thing I would add to that conversation is a lot of important stocks already have, right? When we talk about the top of the market. Microsoft has, Google has, Meta is back to where it was at the COVID lows, right? So kind of go down the line, and a lot of big names, a lot of big weights have already, I think, started to reflect that risk.
Chris, lost decades aren't unheard of. You given much thought to that at all recently when it comes to the U.S. Equity market?
It's funny that you mentioned it, Jonathan. Earlier in the year, we wrote something to the effect of, you know, the most provocative thing we could say is not that the S&P is going to go a ton lower, because I think everyone was pretty bearish, but that the S&P is not going to make much progress for a long period of time. And, you know, that's a view that we've kind of embraced here as you've kind of make this transition from QE to QT. I think at a minimum, when you look at the very liquidity sensitive assets out there, new IPOs, Bitcoin, high multiple software stocks, I think those things are done as your leadership for a very, very long time. That's been our view. That remains our view. So I think when you look at those, you know, very speculative corners of the market, they are saying, even if the S&P lows are in here, there is no new liquidity cycle in front of us.
The reason I bring this up, and I imagine it's the reason you're thinking about it too, is that we've just blown up a decade of QE forever and ZERP. Yeah. And I just struggle, Chris, and we're all living this in real time, I just struggle to understand why 12 months of raising interest rates and doing a bit of QT and then we go back to where we were before. These are big moves. It's not just the Fed. It seems to be pretty much everyone with the exception of, say, the BOJ. I mean, why would it take just 12 months to reverse 10 years of that? And then the consequences are, oh, yeah, we just go back to the old playbook in about six, nine months.
Jenna. I'm with you. I think to kind of maybe use a little bit of a cliche, this does look and feel like regime change. And I think the one chart or the one exhibit that speaks to that, it's on the Bloomberg terminal, is that dollar value of negative yielding debt. You know, we went from $18 trillion of negative yielding debt as recently as a year ago. It's down to about $1 trillion today. So if you're looking for regime change, I think there's no better exhibit of it than that.
Is this a regime change when it comes to nominal yield, or is this a regime change when it comes to real yield? Are we going to see real yields continue to climb as people price in a very different response from central banks?
Well, it's both. And I think the thing about real yields, right, it's somewhat fashionable to say that real yields are positive, or that, you know, real yields are above 1%, but not really. I mean, the Fed funds rate is still well below the rate of inflation. So in any practical sense for savers, real yields are not positive here yet. So I think ultimately, as we've seen in every single cycle going back the last 50 years, the Fed funds rate will overcome the rate of inflation. That's when the Fed has done enough. And I think there's certainly time before we get there, Lisa.
Are people positioned for what you're expecting, Chris, this sort of accident or something breaking?
No, I think, you know, when you look at what positioning looks like, there is a decade of residual positioning at the top of the market, the big weights that have been so reliable for so long. And kind of our view is, again, whether it's market up or market down, that's actually less important. What's more important here is this massive leadership change that we've seen. I'm very reminded of in 2002 when the NASDAQ bottomed in October of 2002, right? It bottomed with everything in October of 2002. It continued to underperform for the next 4 years. So your price low in NASDAQ, I don't think will be your price low in relative performance. That is the big takeaway from us. The leadership picture has changed dramatically here.
Interesting. Hey, Chris, great call on the end, buddy. And I'm sorry for laughing.
Thank you.
I'll never laugh again. I will. Chris Farrant, a strategist.
That's good.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code Radio20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.
Nobody ever says make it complicated. That is why Nationwide makes simplicity a priority by providing financial professionals with straightforward, client-ready resources. From clear strategies to help clients meet retirement savings and income needs, to ways to cover rising healthcare costs and more, Nationwide simplifies planning so more time can be spent helping clients. Nationwide is on your side. Nationwide Investment Services Corporation, member FINRA, Columbus, Ohio.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way. From design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival.
Let's get straight to Alicia Levine, the head of equities and capital market advisory at BNY Mellon Wealth Management. Alicia, how big is the risk that we're heading back towards something like 3,400?
Look, I think it's a 50% odds on that we go there, simply because all year the equity market has really been following the bond market here. And as 10-year yields move higher and push through 3.5%, that's our trigger for another move lower from here. So when 3,900 couldn't hold, which was sort of that last vestige of support, where there was a lot of supply and a lot of trading previously technically, when that didn't hold, you know, it was just kind of clear that as you move bond yields up, equity markets are going lower. And really for good reason, because the top of the market are high growth and tech stocks, where the valuations will come down as yields move higher. So it's a neat little equation. Unfortunately, it's playing out, and that opens up downside from here. But as you say, that 366, the June 17th low, is not that far away from here. It's not a heroic call to say that anymore.
Are we pricing in the weakness that we're hearing from the likes of Ford, from the likes of FedEx, that already are starting to sound some profit warnings?
So in an interesting way, your conversation about how does this conversation change, right? How do we move higher from here? It is our view that the way the equity market can climb out of this hole that it's kind of gotten itself in is for estimates to finally come down and for realistically to price in the slowdown in growth, because it's all been driven by yields. Even now, estimates are holding in there. You know, the forward 12-month on the S&P is something like 17 times. And if you take energy out of it, it's 19 times. That is not a cheap market. And it's not a market reflecting a slowdown in growth. That has to happen. And I think if you realistically reset growth expectations and earnings, then you can begin to bottom. But until that happens, wholesale, then I think we're sort of stuck in this purgatory for a while.
So this is the part of the conversation where equity strategists wear their bond hats, because it's all about rates. And this is what we've been seeing for a long time. And so you have to come up with a call of whether we're getting to peak hawkishness, whether people are already pricing in more than the Fed could potentially do. Do you have a call on that? Is that something that you want to game out? Or is there some kind of relative trade that seems a little bit more insulated from those macro guessing games?
Great question. I think that the risk is actually to more hawkishness here, simply because if you think about that CPI print was pretty devastating for the Fed dot plots, I think, and for the terminal rate on the Fed funds. So that likely goes higher. If that goes higher, multiples get compressed further. But that hasn't happened yet. So I think there is some thought that we're getting to peak hawkishness, but that's not going to move the market now. It's the earnings that are going to move the market, and a realistic reset of where we're going in this. So, yes, there are relative valuations. Look, in the end, this is a short duration market. It has been a short duration market. Same in equities, and not just in bonds. So we still like that utilities are fine. Some staples are fine. Safety is fine. We love real assets. We are, you know, allocating our clients to real assets because we do think we are in a regime change where inflation remains higher for longer and rates remain higher for longer as a result. And all you have to do is listen to some of the workers' strikes that are going on out there, what happened with the rail strike. I mean, these are huge wage increases. This is a change for the economy, and the rates are going to reflect that going forward. I don't think we're going back to a world where you have, 1% yields on the 10-year, and let's have a party and buy, high growth, no earning tech stocks. So we're still in that short duration world. And to your question, are bonds an alternative? Not on the long end, but on the short end, they certainly are doing better. And whether a 4% yield on a 2-year is fully reflecting inflation on a real basis, it is not, but it's sure a lot better than losing money in the equity market.
Alicia, just quickly, what's your time horizon for all of this? It's so well put together. When you start thinking about these issues sticking with us for longer, how much longer? Are we talking years? Are we talking 5, 10? What is it?
So, look, I was trained as a historian, and I look at things in big picture ways. In the short term, I think we get a nice bump coming out of the election, okay? Mid-year elections are notoriously difficult leading up to it, and you never lose money in the 12-month after the election since 1942. So we likely have a rally coming out of the election, and it could be sustainable because we'll get to that peak nastiness heading into it, right? We have terrible seasonality now, better seasonality by the end of the year. So we're optimistic for how this year can stabilize and move higher. Looking forward, I think you have to have a more intellectual view of where yields can be and where the market is and where we can grow. And one of my favorite things to do is just look at, the top 10 stocks of the S&P or the top 10 stocks of the Dow, the beginning of every decade, to see the change of where capital is being allocated and what the growth companies are. And I think you can make a good case that some of these large cap tech is where the risk is here.
Let's just avoid the Dow. Just stick to the S&P. Don't encourage Tom.
Isn't some
Alicia
people
great?
Do that.
One of the best. Alicia
she
Levine
is.
Of Wynn Y. Mellon.
That was fabulous.
Wealth Management.
The housing market very much in the forefront as we watch yields rise because mortgage rates have been climbing so significantly, and there's no one better to speak to this than Jonathan Miller, who has decades studying the industry, president and CEO of Miller Samuel. He always puts out these fantastic reports that gives these real deep dives into what's actually happening on the ground. And we're talking about the pain. We're talking about home builder sentiment rolling over yesterday. We're talking about what it means to have a mortgage rate at 6%, and you are still seeing bidding wars. Are we underestimating the demand, the strength in this housing market?
Well, absolutely. Before the Fed was raising rates, bidding wars in most of the markets we cover across the country were somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of all transactions. Southern California was 2/3 of transactions. There's still bidding wars now, so it's just much more muted. I think the narrative is that, you can hear crickets, and that is not the case. It's just not what it was, and what it was wasn't sustainable.
But how much are we speaking about idiosyncratic markets, right? I mean, the market in Connecticut, for example, very different than the market in Phoenix, Arizona, or the market in San Francisco. How much are we seeing potholes where you are seeing wholesale declines in prices in some areas, particularly the Sun Belt darlings, whereas other areas are holding in more significantly?
I think the chatter on pricing is more about sellers cutting asking prices more than wholesale price declines throughout a region. In aggregate in these regions, because inventory is so low, even with the increases that we've seen, there's a fairly firm underpinning under price. It's certainly, I'm not saying we're not looking at some sort of price decline a couple quarters out or, sometime in 2023. But I don't see this as a correction scenario because the market was wildly overweighted on the demand side going into this, and inventory was literally obliterated. A typical market, a sub-market might have 200 listings. Just before the Fed rate increases in the beginning of the year, there might have been 10 listings, 12 listings. Now there's 50. It's still 75% below. I mean, that's sort of the scenario we're seeing. In the different markets that we cover.
But just to push back, we're seeing the just the volume of sales drop off a cliff. And a lot of times that's a precursor to price drops that are more substantial, right? It really is a matter of where people are willing to transact, especially if their all-in borrowing costs are rising by hundreds of dollars a month. I mean, at what point does that housing, the sales slowdown translate into something materially in price?
Yeah, so typically there's an average of about a 15-month lag between sales correction and some kind of price decline. I think what many people get wrong in a market pivot like this is the scenario is external event, sales activity falls, then inventory rises, and then because there's more supply, prices correct. But housing prices are sticky on the downside that they take longer to fall than they do to rise. And we're in that sort of discovery period right now. But what's different is that supply in general is still relatively low as compared to historical norms.
Jonathan, you were talking about how just because rent increases are slowing down doesn't mean you're going to see a decline in rents. And you've talked before how rents typically are pretty sticky, that they don't go down that much.
Right.
Does that mean that the transmission mechanism of mortgage rates where they are is going to be largely ineffective at bringing down some of the base costs like rents, like housing prices that people are imagining is the case?
Right. I think, housing is about 30% of CPI and it's owner's equivalent rent. It's not, any kind of correction in housing prices is going to bear little impact on or limited impact on inflation because it's owner's equivalent rent. And effectively what's been happening is you have a slowdown in the sales market, and largely because of the loss of affordability with a spike in mortgage rates. Mortgage rates are literally double what they were at the end of December. And the scenario ends up, you're pushing those people into the rental market, which is already tight, which keeps rents elevated, which makes me worry that the Fed path is going to be longer than we think in terms of pressing rates higher.
How high could mortgage rates go in your view?
Who knows? It's funny, about a year ago, I was basically saying that rates should be in the fives. That would be a more normalized market, maybe the sixes. I'm skeptical that they can leave the sixes, but I still think there's some upward movement going forward. There's no, barring a recession, I mean, the idea that the Fed is taking a baseball bat to the economy is something that has to factor in housing since it's so large. And I'm not sure if that's going to be effective just because of the owner's equivalent rent calculation driving rents or keeping rents high. The opposite of rising rent is not falling rent. It's stabilizing rent, in my view. And the only thing that's going to bring rents down is going to be some sort of recession, at least at this point.
Jonathan, 20 seconds. Have we overdone the back to cities trend or is that going to continue?
I think it stays where it is. It's pretty close to that. This is not returning to the mean sort of scenario. We've been working from home too long for this pattern to go away.
Jonathan Miller of Miller Samuel, thank you so much for being with us. I always love speaking with you.
This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.